It's an honor and a complete pleasure to be here to have this conversation. I'm looking forward to the Q&A afterwards to hear more from all of you about what your thoughts are. But what I'm doing today is thinking about how Islanders are policy pioneers. In fact, a number of the policy proposals that have come down the line that are getting more attention these days were actually generated by Islanders who recognize almost 2.5 decades ago that they have a particular vulnerability and are hoping to address it. And in fact, they're pioneers that need our support in actually being able to institute, introduce, and elaborate on some of the policies that they've suggested at the international scale. So a little bit more about my background very quickly. I teach climate change law and policy, as I was introduced as that person, that professor, but I also look really at issues of climate justice. We're looking at vulnerability generally with respect to law and policy. I look a lot at where some of the novel areas of the law with respect to climate-induced migration, what we often hear as climate refugees. And I'm trying to think about new ways to allow the law to evolve, to be appropriately responsive to the new issues of climate change and the new kinds of disasters that climate change introduces. So I can't overstate the relevance of the framing that's been offered with respect to what's happened in Vanuatu. Island nations are seeing the development that they've experienced over the last few years being wiped out in a day in some cases. Some of that is much more slow going, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. But what we're finding, and some of the language that's come out of Vanuatu after this most recent storm, is that there's a desire to not have to go around with a begging bowl. This is language that was being used. A desire to have more sophisticated responses to the 21st century type of disaster. There's a heightened call for a global compensation fund, better infrastructure, better disaster risk management processes and response systems. These are all component parts, again, of a two decade and a half old call for loss and damage mechanisms in the international negotiations, which might be a surprise, but I'm going to say a little bit more about that in the course of this talk. And the talk, I will say, is really based on an article that I've written that will be out in sort of hard copy in a couple of weeks, and it's a rehabilitation, a proposal for climate compensation mechanisms for small island states. The outline here is sort of for the full, 45-minute talk that I'm going to spare you today. But suffice it to say is that what I try to do in these kinds of talks is to give a little bit of background from the perspective of the law. What we understand about climate change is usually steeped in a very scientific conversation. I put a legal and policy lens on it to say, well, what's relevant about the science that makes us think differently? Usually a brief history of the loss and damage system mechanism offered under the Framework Convention on Climate Change with some more details. But again, the proposal I'll save for the moment and just really talk about what is the instigating environment for that kind of proposal and what we mean by loss and damage. So first, the progression, the spectrum. When we've talked about policy with respect to climate change over the years, it was primarily mitigation. We were looking at reducing emissions at the international level. In some ways, adaptation was controversial. The use of the term suggested that we were sort of giving up on a more rigorous approach to reducing emissions. But in fact, adaptation became less of a dirty word, if you will, in the late 2000s. And we embraced that and understood that in spite of how rigorously or not we try to reduce emissions, that we will still have to deal with the climate that is the climate change that's sort of in the pipeline, right, that we already have committed to. We're now at a point, I think, where conversation is going beyond adaptation. And other mechanisms that we thought may not be necessary are in fact necessary. We're finding that we need to look at insurance, risk transfer mechanisms, and the possibility of compensation for those things that are completely lost. And this is the loss and damage discussion. When we say loss and damage, together the term has sort of a more technical definition, and it describes the actual and or potential manifestation of impacts associated with climate change in developing countries that negatively affect human and natural systems. Now, in sort of more informal language, loss is what it sounds like, and damage is what it sounds like. Loss is impacts that that for which restoration is not possible. And these are quite novel impacts. This would be the total destruction of coastal infrastructure due to sea level rise, or the total collapse of a fishery due to lower ocean pH or ocean acidification. And damage refers to the negative impacts that you can restore, right? At least restoration is possible. So this would be damage to coastal mangrove forests due to storm surge. It would also be those things that we generally understand as things that we could adapt to if we had instituted appropriate adaptation efforts and disaster risk management, or we could mitigate or avoid these impacts, right? Now, the loss and damage that was described and is being elaborated by small island states in particular sort of falls through the governance gaps right now. The climate regime is not addressing these specific issues, and there's been a push over the years to have greater attention to these three prongs. One is disaster risk management. The other is risk transfer through insurance and other novel mechanisms for fast disbursement of funds after a disaster. And then this piece on compensation, or I would say euphemistically, rehabilitation. Okay, and why is there more attention on this? Because again, we're looking at costs that are quite large, and a significant percentage of the GDP of many of these countries that this cost would represent in any given event, and then of course over time. And this is true even if we were to stick to the most optimistic scenario of capping a temperature increase to 2 degrees Celsius. Interestingly, some of the events that we're looking at are the extreme events that are most strongly associated with climate change. This is important because attribution for lawyers in particular is incredibly important. Are you making the correct link? Is this really about climate change? What other contributions are increasing your vulnerability for which I'm not responsible or the international community does not need to manage under the umbrella of the climate negotiation? And we see the kinds of events that are going to impact and currently are impacting island nations that have a slow march, many of them. In other words, increasing heat, coastal flooding, especially due to sea level rise, these severe droughts that lead to desertification. These are slow onset events that we're seeing happening more and more, and they're very strongly linked, at least as the evidence offers us now, to climate change. So that's relevant. Another slide that I think is helpful, that we pulled this together for the Pacific Islands Regional Climate Assessment, which is part of the National Climate Assessment. This is a schematic that offers a little bit of the impacts that we are seeing in island nations. And even though this is obviously a very nondescript island, it's really quite relevant across most island nations. And the kinds of impacts we're seeing are quite varied. So in addition to increased land surface temperatures, we're seeing increased ocean heat content, sea surface temperatures. All of these are pretty standard across the board, and we're seeing this happen in places like the Caribbean and the Pacific Islands that are known to have pre-existing vulnerabilities. We also know that places that have increases in sea level rise and coastal inundation are also places for which half the population resides within a mile of the shore. And almost without exception, the IPCC says, international airports, roads, capital cities, and small islands of the Indian and Pacific Oceans and the Caribbean Sea are sited along the coast or on tiny coral islands. So I failed to mention this in my bio. I'm born in Kingston, so I'm from Jamaica. I now raise my children on Oahu. I joke that I spent most of my childhood and schooling on Long Island and the Manhattan Island. I am an islander and varied islands, and islands have this kind of vulnerability. We're seeing that this is pretty static across the board. But again, of course, what differentiates, say, Manhattan and Honolulu from places like Jamaica is that the amount of resources that can be used to actually make you more resilient in the face of some of these storms is not available, right? And so even though small island nation states generally are responsible for less than 1% of global greenhouse gas emissions, small islands are already expending scarce resources on strategies to adapt to growing climate threats and to also repair themselves after they have hit. So we have, Kingston I've shown as an example, just by coincidence. We have seen that there are going to be major impacts. This I show as an example of heat extremes. My colleague at the University of Hawaii, Camilo Mora, has done a very groundbreaking article on climate departure. This was published in Nature, and what it was essentially demonstrating was that it will be a period of time at which the average temperature in this particular area will be higher, that the low will be higher than the highest average prior to the certain date. So he's looking at the year of departure. When does that flip happen? When is the lowest average temperature higher than the highest average that we've experienced during normal years? And this is somewhere between 2047 and 2069. This is quite soon. So, and in fact, the sooner periods of time will actually be experienced first in tropical regions and islands as well. So Kingston and Honolulu were identified in this particular article that came out as of particular concern. I offer this image to say something about how I try to understand the loss element as well in a more sort of metaphorical way, if you will. This is an image. We had a pretty intense heat event in September in Honolulu, and this actual article was in the Daily newspaper, and it was really meant to convey the absence of the sort of tragedy of the absence of air conditioning in our schools. And you see that the temperatures in the classrooms, in the lunchroom, were peaking at 101 degrees, 96 degrees, 94 degrees. I have two young children, and I was sort of imagining what the lost opportunity is here when you have children that are attempting to learn under these circumstances. In Honolulu, it requires an adaptive response of getting better airflow and air conditioning, but in other places, this might be more difficult, and it's something to consider. Back to the Pacific, at least the South Pacific. We are in the North Central Pacific in Hawaii, but we are seeing some of the other events that I'd shown as far as extreme weather events. And again, we're seeing abnormally wet conditions in Guam. We have long-term drought impacts in the Republic of the Marshall Islands. Again, there's sea level rise that's going to be relevant to all of these places as well. And in this unfortunate sort of collision of climatic sort of progression in the Western Pacific, we're seeing more sea level rise than we're seeing in other places. This is due to some more complex dynamics, but this is overlaid on the sea level rise that we're experiencing as a result of climate change. So when you hear about these events in the South Pacific, in Vanuatu, the movement of peoples in Papua New Guinea, this is some of the science behind it. So sea level rise is chief among the impacts to small islands, and it makes events like Cyclone Pam that much more destructive when they do hit in these areas. Now, with that backdrop, the question is how do we handle these issues? So again, mitigation has been primarily the job of developed countries, and I think for everyone now as we move forward. But for developing countries, a lot of the conversation is about how best to adapt, how to find the resources and to do it most efficiently. But a fascinating study was done in 9 locations to determine whether or not adaptation is actually working. And Micronesia was one of the places in which they'd studied coastal erosion and attempts to make your community more resilient. They'd ask communities how many of them had adopted adaptation measures. More than half had. They also asked, since you've adopted these adaptation measures, were they effective? And 92% said they still experienced adverse effects despite having introduced some sort of adaptation measure. This seemed to be significant and underscore concerns that were actually introduced years before by Vanuatu, in fact, in the early 90s, but then championed by the Alliance of Small Island States, which is this mechanism for loss and damage. So the Alliance of Small Island States is actually a negotiating bloc, a coalition of small island and low-lying coastal countries that they share the same development challenges as well as the same concerns about the environment, and in particular, climate change. It's within the UN system. It represents almost 60 million individuals, citizens, 44 states, and states that are across the globe. So the Pacific, the Indian and Atlantic Oceans, the Mediterranean, Caribbean, and South China Seas. These are low-lying coastal states that share similar sustainable economic development challenges, and again, concerns about climate. They are very diverse in terms of income, although most are middle and low income. Some are among the least developed countries in the world, and we have outliers like Singapore. But again, many of the impacts that they're experiencing are quite shared. The Pacific Islands in particular, and especially Vanuatu, they're situated in one of the most natural disaster-prone regions, highly susceptible to floods, droughts, tropical cyclones, and other disasters that compromise their ability to live without some kind of external shock to their economy and well-being. So the Alliance of Small States has been trying to think very expansively about how we respond. Again, moving beyond simply mitigation and adaptation as the sole policy responses. And this graph shows some of the ways you could think about the loss and damage mechanism that they're introducing, because they're recognizing that there, again, is a spectrum at which you can perhaps introduce risk management measures, so everything from soil techniques to help with agriculture during stress times, building codes and enforcement, watershed management. That's the disaster risk reduction pieces. Then there's risk transfer. Again, once there is an event, Once a storm has come, how do you get back on your feet rapidly? That's what we use insurance for, so we can have rapid disbursement of funds during those periods. But then there's this other piece that's being sort of called residual risk. It's sort of a catch-all. I sometimes jokingly quote Donald Rumsfeld to say these are the known unknowns, right? What happens on beyond this period of time? And in fact, we see that that's where a lot of the controversy is occurring right now. Generally speaking, it's difficult to move these policy pieces because of inertia in a number of spaces, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. But this is the most controversial because it includes notions of liability, responsibility, compensation, again, euphemistically, rehabilitation. And what we're dealing with in that area usually is the unavoidable and uninsurable risk. These are the things that are the slow onset events. This is desertification. You're in a part of the world where you are unable to grow food any longer. This piece of land is no longer viable. Thanks. This is also true, again, of sea level rise. This is ocean acidification, again, which I should note that is not climate change, but is sort of the evil twin. And then non-economic losses, these are impacts to your culture, your tradition. This also includes, but I set apart, migration and displacement, because migration and displacement are such massive issues that we're beginning to think more about. So what we're dealing with in the sort of extreme end of loss and damage is this piece. And again, it's we're hearing more of it, and certainly events like Cyclone Pam have reignited conversation about it in the general public discourse. But this has been a longstanding effort. Again, we see as a policy progression, we were talking primarily about mitigation, then adaptation, now enhanced adaptation. This notion of loss and damage being a key sort of frontier for us at the international negotiation level is quite clear. And then loss and damage has been, since the 90s, something of concern, again, for AOSIS and similarly situated countries. And in fact, loss and damage has had some key dates that date back to 1991 through all of the COP meetings. And again, if anyone would like to see my slides, I'm happy to share them. But this just basically goes through a timeline that shows you just the sort of the long tail of the loss and damage conversation in the international negotiations. And what happened, it sort of came to fruition in Poland, in Warsaw, a year and a half ago. And what we saw was an advance in the conversation in that there was an acknowledgement that loss and damage was real and that it perhaps needed some response. And the decision itself, in the second sort of fuller paragraph, acknowledges that loss and damage associated with adverse effects of climate change includes, and in some cases involves more than that which can be reduced by adaptation. This was a victory of sorts in terms of having this acknowledged in this particular document, there being a mechanism that was going to be introduced. There were detractors, though, that felt that this was as a result of a lot of compromise, and importantly, did not have action points to it. Was really more an effort to continue to study, and studies would be the results of the study would be released in 2016, which is after this year's very important COP meeting in Paris this December. So there are a number of concerns about what's happening post-Warsaw. Right now, the mechanism's executive committee, how it should operate, what to expect out of the work plan, the exact details of it, whether or not it'll be action-oriented, these are all being finalized right now. So, Cyclone Pam becomes this interesting instigating point for reigniting the conversation. There is actually a draft document for Paris that includes three possible mentions of loss and damage. The first elaborates much more of how it would be introduced and financed. The second is basically a statement to refer back to prior decision-making on it. And the third is a line that says no mention or something to that effect, right? But I think that third option is becoming less and less possible as we see countries that themselves have stories of resilience at the base and in communities that need the international support to continue to do those things. Quickly, a couple of hurdles that are experienced in the loss and damage conversation, just to make it clear. I've alluded to some of them. There are liability concerns by primarily developed countries or wealthier countries, global north countries, that are concerned that if there is an acknowledgement of a need for a loss and damage mechanism, if there is language like compensation, that that means that there is a payout that needs to happen, and that's a sort of non-starter in terms of negotiation. I call the second the sort of strange South-South bedfellows phenomenon, which is that obviously the global South, developing countries are quite diverse, and who needs or has the more sort of compelling argument for loss and damage are those that are the low and middle income countries that are, really do need the support in these areas. There's also funding and donor fatigue issues. So obviously we know that we have how the several different numbers. One number is how much we actually need to invest in order to reduce emissions to keep ourselves under 2 degrees. This is anywhere between $500 billion to $1 trillion per year by some estimates. We have how much is actually allocated for adaptation, for which we need more money, and that's in the billions range. All of this is far greater and dwarfs by magnitudes, orders of magnitude, the amount of actual funding that's been pledged, the amount of funding that has been promised by 2020, and the anticipation is that this will leverage other funds. But again, the large pie is only a fraction of what we need to address mitigation, adaptation, and then, of course, not really even including the needs for loss and damage and migration. So there's some issues there. But it's important here to understand this is just a graphic that describes the differences in the pledge, promise, and actual need. What we see, though, is that these events might continue to happen. And so I would encourage all of us to think about how we can continue to support these communities, and thinking as I wrap up about how we can identify and understand resilience as well. Obviously, what happened in Vanuatu, this is a long-term struggle. This has initiated a lot of development needs moving forward, but there are a lot of stories of resilience that are, in addition to the policy pioneering that I've discussed, that are also quite heartening. There's a sort of widely embodied spirit in which communities in Vanuatu are being interviewed and are discussing what the impacts of these storms are. And probably one of the best stories I've heard, and it's just one story, but was about this man who had lost his home, and roofing material from another building just landed on his entire house. And he was like, my house is gone, but look at all this new material. And there was a sense of, let's get on with this, let's rebuild this. And I think, again, this is a widely embodied spirit, certainly within the region. And we see places like the Carteret Islands, the Solomon Islands, we're seeing communities that have to move, and are seeing atoll nations with communities that are being carved up by sea level rise, being quite resilient in their storytelling, and their ability to use community networks and creativity and ambitions about economic development in different ways to their advantage. And I close with this picture of Ursula Rakova because she is one of my heroes. She is heading the efforts by the people of the Carteret Islands in Papua New Guinea to relocate her community of some 2,000 people. And what she has done with the request of the Council of Elders is to lead the effort to have a permanent resettlement in their neighboring mainland area. It's an attempt to be self-reliant. It is thoughtful, it is careful, and it is caring. And I think we have an opportunity here to continue to support this kind of work because, again, there's a widely embodied spirit that I certainly have learned and gained much from. So thank you, and I look forward to the Q&A.